Six music.
This is a BBC Radio Six Music documentary.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. This week's guest is a member of arguably the best band in the world right now. Rarely for a group of their popularity, over the course of their 9-album career, they become more and more adventurous, evolving from a conventional guitar rock outfit into a group of musicians who've absorbed and interpreted the electronic underground, progressive jazz and post-rock to create something unique. Likewise, my guest this week has developed his role from guitarist in the band to become a programmer, producer, and someone who's used their original instrument to create the sounds, atmospheres, and textures that characterise so much of the group's work. My guest on the first time this week is from Radiohead, Ed O'Brien.
Just as you take my hand, just as you write my number down, just as the drinks arrive, just as they play up.
Here Ed talks about his childhood, one dominated by the pop charts, his early passion for the more unusual guitar heroes that emerged after punk, and his first impressions of meeting the school friends that would go on to become Radiohead. He also discusses the band's early musical insecurities, their unusual and often tough route to recognition, and their reaction to the attention that followed. Ed also looks back at the band's amazing back catalogue, explaining how the Bends was a reaction to being called one-hit wonders, the joy of the OK Computer sessions, and how the group had to rethink their whole approach to creating music with Kid A and Amnesiac. We also cover his love of Brazilian music, his plans for a solo album, and I might have even asked about Glastonbury 2017. But I started by asking Ed, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
There was a lot of music in the house. My parents were young. I was the firstborn. So we had a Pi record player. And the first album I really remember is being about 1970, 71, is Bridge Over Troubled Water.
When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are
amazing record. Music, everyone. My dad and mum both worked downstairs on the ground floor of the house, and my dad would come up and occasionally pull out my mum's classical guitar he couldn't play and then sing a Creedence song or Rock Island Line. I remember him singing that.
Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride, yes. The Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like you finally get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
There was always lots and lots of music in the house, and very, very diverse, very diverse.
And you were always fascinated by it. It always appealed to
you. I just loved it. I mean, you know, I'm born in 68, so the 70s, top of the pops in the charts, that was the thing that drew me in, and I just loved it. I was in a choir when I was a kid, so I did classical singing and all of that, and there were lots of musicals that my mum used to take us to, but the charts, you know, my dad would sit down, he'd make me cassettes of the charts. The charts were everything, and pop music was so great then.
And that first single that you got from like Boots or
not
wherever
so
it was.
Not so auspicious, I'll be honest. I could say it was something like Baggy Trousers, but don't. I'm going to be totally honest.
Uh-huh.
78, it was Ali's Tartan Army, the Scottish World Cup song.
Right, okay. Yeah. I'm not massively familiar with that track.
We are the. I actually know some of the words, but I'll. There may be a few listeners who do.
Okay. First album?
First album. I would also like to give it context that I would have bought singles earlier, but my dad did me cassettes every week of the top 40 rundown. So I would have gone out earlier, A, if I'd had pocket money.
Just excuses.
No, maybe. And B, there was no need. So the first album I bought, well, I think it was the Beatles Rock and Roll Music Volume 1. I was a total Beatles nut from about 76 onwards. And they had this compilation album of tracks from the first four albums that were kind of Long Tall Sally, Roll Over Beethoven, Kansas City, Twist and Shout, and they put them all, and it was the rock and roll songs, and that was the thing that I loved.
Ah, Kansas City, gonna get my baby back home. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to Kansas City, gonna get my baby back home. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a long, long time since my baby's been gone.
The first album that my dad gave me was Sgt. Pepper's, and I listened to it, I was like, I don't really like this. I like the stuff where they're kind of like, and they're, so that's where I sort of gravitated. So that was the first album I bought.
Were you one of those kids that stood there with the tennis racket in front of the mirror?
No.
When did guitar become a thing?
Okay.
When did you want to be a guitar hero?
Two things. So it was sonically, it was a sound. I remember it was hearing Walking on the Moon by the Police. That was the thing, that it was the sound, and that this record actually sounded like they were playing this on the moon. Andy Summers, the guitarist, has got echo on their delay. Mm-hmm. He's got a bit of chorus and also the chords that he's playing, the voicings. So that was the thing that kind of pulled me in. I was just like, oh, I really like this. It really moved me in a kind of way that it's a sound that's like, wow. But the other thing was, around the same time, going into WH Smith, and they had all the posters, and you know, and you go through them, and there was one of The Jam. It's a gig shot, and Weller's with his Rickenbacker, and he's mid-leap.
Oh, sort of scissor-legged.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And Rick Buckler's at the back, and Bruce Foxton's just giving it all that. And I just, that was such a powerful image to me.
That's wild.
Yeah, that's, and it was kind of like, whoa. But no one played guitar around us. You know, it was all classical instruments. There was no kind of, I didn't know anyone who played guitar, classical or anything. There were no electric guitars. There was nowhere to buy them. So it seemed that a seed was planted, but it didn't seem, it's like, how do you get to that? Didn't know how to get there. I've never been a fan of Million Mile an Hour guitarists. There are some amazing guitarists now who I really like. But when those formative years, it was all about the guys like Andy Summers, The Edge, Will Sargent from The Bunnymen. I mean, I put Weller in there as well because he was, okay, there was no delay, but it was such an aggressive,
a visceral,
yeah,
sound.
Beautiful, that AC30 with the Rick. Johnny Marr, of course. Johnny was a massive,
yeah,
for me. And I was lucky because the whole post-punk thing was a very fertile period, wasn't it? And people were able to do this and put this within the context of pop music.
What's the Marr track that we should play, or the Smiths song that you like? Because he doesn't play like anybody.
No.
No one else can play like that.
The first track that I heard by them was What Difference Does It Make? But I think for me, the one that still floors me is This Charming Man. And it's the chorus, the voicings that he gets on that, the sevenths that he does on that. When I first heard Johnny play, I'm sure like a lot of us, there are so many Smiths fans out there. It was the kind of the yin and yang of Morrissey and Marr and the band. But there's something about Johnny's melodies and the layerings that just really spoke to me in such a sort of, you know, profound way, and uplifted many of us, didn't they? And certainly for me, he was a massive thing. But I could never work out. You can never learn how to play a Smith song. But, you know.
What were your first impressions of the other guys when you first met them at school?
Well, the big thing about the difference about our band was, like most school bands, they're formed from people of the same year. Ours was from different years. So Phil was in the year above me, and I didn't really know him. He was kind of this enigmatic figure. He was a drummer in the coolest band in school. They were called Jungle Telegraph.
That's a terrible name.
I think he's quite good. He was in the coolest band, and they did gigs at the Jericho Tavern in Oxford, which was, you know, when you're in the sixth form, that's as cool as it gets. Colin and Tom were in the year below me. I met Colin when I was in the third year. He was in the second year because we did a lot of acting together.
All right.
And I had a New Order badge. And I think Temptation had just come out, or it was early, early days. And he came up and go, "Do you like New Order?" And I was like, "Yeah, I like New Order." So we started talking, and he was just a really lovely, kind kid. When we had some, like all schools do, they have some gnarly kids. Talk of gnarly kids. No. And then Tom, I remember, because he'd be on the same bus as my sister, get the school bus in, the Farringdon bus. And I remember seeing him on the bus because he was quite aggressive. And also I remembered him because I remember I opened a desk at school and there's Tom York loves Anna O'Brien, was my sister. So he obviously had a crush on, or maybe someone else wrote it. And then Tom and Colin and myself were in a lot of plays together at school. You know, usually there wasn't a lot of cross-pollination between years, but because the whole acting thing and being in that block, which the acting block was the music block as well, people were a lot nicer, if you like, a lot kinder and got on. So there was always a warmth. And then Johnny, I just remember, because he grew, I don't know why I remember, but he was about 4 years younger than me, but I remember he grew before a lot of the other kids. And I remember this kid, like, standing on the rugby field, towering over everyone. It was Johnny. So they were the kind of the first impressions. Tom was kind of belligerent. Tom and Colin's year were just gnarly. They were just
there's
horrible.
There's always one year.
And they were just, they had these characters in that year and they pick on people. And I think Tom used to fight back. He was a real fighter because they used to have a go at him and he would just give as good as he got, which he needed to do. And Colin, I kind of kept to the side of it. So yeah, they were kind of the first impressions.
What were the first recordings that you did as on a Friday?
It was the summer of 86, and it was a four-track in Philip's bedroom. I remember it because Queen Is Dead had just come out, and we had a song that sounded like the Smiths.
Yes.
It was like,
we're doing it.
Called The Fat Girl. It was a really, really lovely lyric that Tom wrote. It was all about the empathy for the fat girl, you know. I think we did four or five tracks. They were the first four tracks in Philip's bedroom. Really hot, roasting like June weekend.
I can't afford to breathe in this town. Nowhere to sit without a gun in my hand. Hook back up to my cathode ray. I'm better off dead. I'm better off dead. I'm better off.
When we started playing together, and it, you can only say this in hindsight because of your experiences in life and how you get on. When we started, I had such a strong sense of like, this is it.
Really?
Like everything went into focus. Life was, before that, it was a bit confusing. It wasn't great. You know, like a lot of kids then, it was a bit crap. What I remember is I'd just been given an acoustic guitar and I just started to play it. And I walked across the gravel in front of the school and I was going to the music school to have a jam with, yeah, whatever that meant at that stage, with a couple of friends. And Tom comes out, and I've known Tom, as I said, from the plays and stuff like that. Tom comes out and goes, "Where are you going?" I said, "Oh, I'm just off to the musical." He said, "Do you mind if I come along?" And I went, "No, of course not." And I remember it kind of like, oh, this is... So, like, I felt something very, very strong.
That's great.
Like, some kind of epiphany, almost like, this is it. And certainly with the band, I mean, you know, those early days, those first three, 4 years, We thought we were the best band on the planet. We weren't. We so weren't. We were so not. And when you do your first proper recordings, like you make your first record, you realise, oh no, we're so not.
We haven't got what we're doing.
No, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in it. Oh shit, we're actually not that good. But I think maybe, and I've spoke to other people in bands, they have similar feelings. You almost need that. It's like in order for that seed to germinate and flourish and grow, you have to have that feeling of utter kind of like conviction. And this is, you know, after that, it was like, this is what matters. This is what really matters. And we all went off to university, but we all kept coming back because that's the thing that makes us resonate. And that's the thing that, yeah, makes us tick. And this is the thing that feels right. It just felt so right.
When did you first think, okay, you said we had a lot of work to do. When did you first think, this is really good? Aside from the confidence, being in the studio and going, that song.
I think probably it took to the second album.
It took all the way to the
band? Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we had moments on the first record. I think we were really happy with, obviously, with Creep. I mean, the whole Pablo Honey experience was really important, and it's just where we were at the time. We just didn't know our ass from our elbow, you know. We hadn't realised quite how one needs to apply oneself, the application. It was funny because on the first record, I mean, a lot of people said we were one-hit wonders. I think the Bends was a response for being touted as one-hit wonders. Mm. It was kind of like, right, we're going to make an album of every song's going to be a potential single. Now, they obviously weren't, but that kind of idea that every song was great. So that's what we tried to do.
Out of step did you feel with what was going on around the Bends?
Obviously, you talk about the whole Britpop era and that being the height of it. I just think we were removed from it, and I think we always gravitated. I'll tell you who for us were a big thing. We just wanted to be Massive Attack, you know.
Okay.
That's who we wanted to be. They were West Country, so they're Bristol. We were kind of Oxford. We weren't in London. They weren't in London. And I remember we did a festival and Massive Attack were playing. It was like Torhüter Werft or something in Belgium. I think it was after Pablo Honey, kind of that 94, before we did the Bends. And they came and watched us. And we were like, oh, God, Massive Attack are here. And they wanted to see us afterwards. And we were like, we were thinking, oh God, we've got to be so apologetic about our music. And they were like, no, we love that song, Creep. And it sounded like Gang of Four. And I was like, I think it was really good for us. It was kind of like, oh, they're really cool and they like our music and we love their sound. I mean, that is a cool sound. You know, that's like that whole thing. So I think we were also slightly scared of the whole London thing and the whole media thing. We were very, very, you know, we just wanted to get on touring and making music. And we realized we had to work hard because we had a lot of work to do.
What's the Massive Attack track we should play?
Oh, Karma Coma.
Why that song?
I think because that album came out when we were going on the sort of press junket for the Benz. Again, it was the era of MTV. So you get into your hotel room, you put MTV on and it was on there. And it's such a powerful... And also it's that thing, there's that kind of trippiness of that record that, you know, a different city each day. And it just... I mean, I loved Mezzanine. I really loved that record. But I think... That record and there's something about Karma Coma and all the sounds on it and just that hypnotic beat that's just undoubtable.
You sure you wanna be with me? I've nothing to give. Don't lie and say this love is best. Don't leave us in emotional pace. Take a walk, taste a rest. No, take a rest.
I seen you digging a hole in your neighborhood. You're crazy, but you're lazy. No need to live in a lean-to. Your troubles must be seen to. See through money like it's paper. With faces I remember. I drink on a daily basis. The way soda cools my temper. It never cools my temper.
Walking through the suburbs, they're not exactly lovers. You're a couple, especially when your body's double duplicate. And then you wait for the next Kuwait. Karma Coma. Jamaica and Roma, Karma Coma. Jamaica and Roma, Karma Coma. Jamaica and Roma.
You sure you wanna be with me? I've nothing to give. Now take a walk, take a rest.
Overcoming 60 seconds with the strength we have together. But for now, emotional ties, they stay severed. When there's trust to be treated, someone with funk will hear beats. Karma Coma. Jamaica and Roma. Karma Coma. Jamaica and Roma. Karma Coma. Jamaica and Roma. Karma Coma. Jamaica and Roma.
Karma Coma by Massive Attack, taken from the 1995 album Protection. The choice of my guest here on the first time this week, Ed O'Brien.
BBC Radio.
BBC Radio.
Six Music.
Full of
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Ed O'Brien from Radiohead. You just heard No Surprises from Radiohead's 1997 album OK Computer. That album, and I don't think I'm being overdramatic here, changed the rock world, taking rock music in a more experimental, ambitious, subtle and challenging direction, setting the course for so much music as the millennium approached. Now, next year, that album will be celebrating its 20th anniversary. I asked Ed for his memories of creating the record.
My impressions are of a young band. It was a really exciting time. Mm. It's like that thing when a band gets into its kind of momentum and inertia. It's almost like whatever you put into it, it sort of comes out okay. And I remember that we were so happy because the Bends seemed to have legs on it. And we did 5 tours of America alone on the Bends. And so even when we were making OK Computer, we'd started recording it, we went back and did another tour.
Wow.
There were gnarly moments, but it was just a time of real flourishing and expansiveness. And we were listening to different music. Like I was listening to Pet Sounds and What's Going On, and there was Bitches Brew. So sonically, we were getting really influenced by a lot of rich, beautiful sounds, if you like.
Yeah.
The first track we recorded was No Surprises. We decided we were going to buy equipment because didn't want to go back into recording studio, wanted to try and do it mobile and a new kind of environment, see how we responded to that. Then we went out and opened up for, not a lot of people know this, Alanis Morissette in America. So she's playing, and this is a really important part of the record. So she's at the height of that on that first record, and she's asked us to come and play, and we've been convinced that it's a good thing to do. And she paid us very well, and they treated us amazingly. So we played all these sheds, and that, you know, the sheds, they're like 18,000.
Enormous.
Yeah, and her audience, it's 90% girls, and they scream. I think we only did like 14, 15 shows with her. And we go on the first 2 shows, and we do, I think we played Creep, and we played songs off the Bends. The only one they responded to was Creep, because it's a pop audience. They didn't know the Bends. And so we go like, hang on a set. How do we use? So we do an 8-song set, and we do 7 the songs we were trying to play in, and Creep. So you play Creep, they go, wah! And it made no difference. But what it means and what happens with us, if you play a song in front of an audience, you very, very quickly get feedback about whether it works. You don't have to wait for the crowd reaction. It's just like, oh God, we shouldn't put the chorus in there. You know, it becomes very obvious. Whereas when you're in your rehearsal room, sometimes you can get a little bit lost. What it meant was that, I mean, we did a 12-minute version of Paranoid Android. Johnny was playing a Hammond organ, kind of John Lord-style-y at the end, this kind of flourishing. It was a monstrosity. It was terrible, but we knew it was terrible. But we knew the first bit was really good. So we got straight off that tour. 3 days later, we were in this house called St. Catherine's in Bath, and we hit the ground running. And the first 3 days, we did Climbing Up the Walls live, Let Down live. And I mean, that thing when you get I'm going to get a bit of a spine tingle now talking about it, is that thing where there was magic.
Brazil.
Yes.
It's a country that means a lot to you. It's whether musically is it a place you have a connection to, because it's not something you've ever talked about.
Yeah, massively.
Yeah.
My thing with Brazilian music started height of OK Computer. I remember it was the summer. I think we'd just done Glastonbury, 97.
Some gig.
And had a couple of weeks holiday. And I was really depressed. You know, I'd always had kind of like a low-level depression, but it became really acute because here I was. I'm in what I consider to be the best band in the world. We've just made what I consider to be a record I'm so proud of. I'm so unhappy. I feel so alone. You know, all those things you shouldn't do, because, you know, when you're depressed or when you're unhappy, you always think, if I get that, that's the thing that's going to make me happy.
That'll solve it.
You know, the love of a good woman, being in the best band in the world, that's all I need. Well, sure enough, you get into what you consider the best, and this position is just like, oh my God, I felt so alone. So I went away on my own. I remember, and I was smoking a lot, and I picked up from the office this Red Hot and Bossa compilation, all these Brazilian tracks, Bossa Nova tracks. And I listened to it, and I went, oh my God. it spoke to me because it had this beauty in it, but it also had what in Brazil they call saudade, which is melancholy. It's a sadness. At the heart of it, there's this, it's this longing to be somewhere else. And I had this real feeling, I wanted to be somewhere else. I wanted to be somewhere where I was happy. Mm. And it was at that moment, and it was then hearing people like Tom Jobim and João Gilberto and Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil and Jorge Ben. All these people were like, I just love that music, this beautiful, uplifting, melodic music, yet it had this kind of, this melancholic heart. From then on, it was there when I met my wife, because this love of South American music. So then we started going to Brazil, and the music has played an enormous part.
What should we play?
Play Jorge Ben, Take It Easy, My Brother Charlie. I think that's just a classic Jorge Ben track off his first album.
Take it easy, my brother Charlie. Take it easy, meu irmão de cor. Take it easy, my brother Charlie. Take it easy, meu irmão de cor. Pois a rosa é uma flor, a rosa é uma cor, a rosa é um nome de mulher. Rosa é a flor da simpatia, a flor escolhida no dia do primeiro encontro do nosso dia. Com a vida, querida, com a vida mais garrida. Take it easy, Charlie. Take it easy, my brother Charlie. Take it easy, meu irmão de cor. Take it easy, my brother Charlie. Take it easy, meu irmão de cor. Depois que o primeiro homem maravilhosamente pisou na lua, eu me senti com direitos, com princípios e dignidade de me libertar. Por isso, sem preconceito, eu canto a fantasia, eu canto o amor, eu canto a alegria, eu canto a fé, eu canto a paz, eu canto a sugestão, eu canto na madrugada. Take it easy, my brother Charlie, pois eu canto até a minha amada, esperada, desejada, adorada. Take it easy, my brother Charlie. Take it easy, meu irmão de cor. Take it easy, my brother Charlie. Take it easy, meu irmão de cor. Take it easy, my brother Charlie.
Charlie.
Take it easy, meu irmão de
take
cor.
Take it easy, my boy.
Take it easy, my brother
take
Charlie.
Take it easy, my friend.
Take it easy, meu irmão
olha,
de cor.
Olha como
take
o céu é azul. Olha como é verde o mar. Olha que sol bonito, Charlie.
Take
it easy, my boy.
Take
it easy, my friend. Tenha calma, meu amigo.
The image that people put on the band is of around Kid A's, sort of you and Johnny putting the guitars in the flight cases, locking the flight cases, yeah. And Philip very earnestly plugging in a drum machine and this is what we're doing now.
Yeah.
Was the reality quite as, I don't know, disciplined as that we are?
No, it wasn't. It was like needs must. Kid A was quite a difficult record to make because we all went in with different ideas. And Tom, of course, you know, was like, it ain't going to be like that, boys. You know, because I was listening to Scott Four. A lot.
A good record.
Oh, amazing records. And also Tusk, Fleetwood Mac. And I thought we were at the height of our powers playing wise. I thought, why don't we make a record like Scott Four? That would be a really warm, beautiful... We can actually play now. For years we were like, we can play, but we can actually play a bit. And it was great because Tom was like, I'm not having this. It was good because it was, this is the music that I'm listening to. This is the music that excites me. So... he opened us all up to like Boards of Canada and Aphex Twin. And that was really important. And it was kind of like, okay, how does a guitar work in all of this? If you want to make, doesn't really. So again, it forces you out of your comfort zone, which is a really good thing. It's not the easiest thing, but it's a really important thing when you're making music. That's where you expand and grow.
But so few bands do it. Because there's a certain amount of humility, there's a certain amount of looking at the wider picture. That's not easy.
No, it's not easy, but it's kind of the only way to be. I think part of it is being honest with yourself and saying, does this feel right? It's a balance, isn't it? It's a balance between the heart and the head. So the head says... you know, you've got to do something new, which is really important. And the heart can also say that as well. We can say, actually, you know what? I'm not really feeling it. It's like when we made King of Limbs, we want to make music together. We didn't want to pick up our instruments again, like on Kid A. So it's just like Tom at that time was a lot more in touch with the feeling of it. So he led us, particularly on that record, in terms of, you know, you should be feeling like this. And actually, he was right. And we were feeling like this.
We have attempted to do something like a full solo album, you know.
Yeah.
Stand there on the mountaintop with the hair going.
And yeah.
And the Les Paul and creates a whole Ed O'Brien.
Yeah. I haven't up until 2 years ago, but I am going to now.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to do one next year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where are we finding inspiration from, music?
Well, interestingly enough, it starts in Brazil.
Excellent.
After the last load of touring, King of Limbs, my kids were born 2004 and 2006. And I said to the guys, in 5 years' time, me and my wife are going to go and live in Brazil for a year. I don't want to put the kibosh on anything, but this is something we have to do. Don't feel you can't make a record. Make a record without me. If I can come in later on, whatever. And I was really aware that I'd had so many adventures with this band. I wanted to have an adventure with my family. So we went to live in Brazil, in the middle of the Brazilian countryside, and we lived on a little farm in basically a hut the size of this room next to a waterfall. Life was really simple.
Wow.
Kids went to the local school. No one could speak English, so they learned, they picked it up, the language of play and stuff. And life was reduced to its simple parts. For me, it was music and my family. And I would go each day, walk up the hill to this beautiful little hut next to this lake, and I started writing, and I took out all this gubbins because Tom said, you know, you're really good at all, you know, you just do all the Pro Tool stuff. So I applied myself because I never really applied to it. And I just sat after about 8 weeks, I was like, I'm not feeling this. This is rubbish. All I want to do is play guitar and sit there. And in February of that year, I got taken to Carnival, and a really close friend of mine invited me and my wife to the Sambadrome in Rio.
The Sambadrome.
Oh my God. It's the greatest show on earth. Two nights, they have 12 samba schools. They're like these processions, all these floats, and they have an hour and 20 minutes. Each samba school parades down what's called the Sambadrome. It's like this mile-long strip. They used it in the Olympics, and it runs from 10 at the night till 6 in the morning. I cannot lie. It was the greatest thing I've ever, ever, ever experienced in terms of music. So, of course, the beats, what they call the batteria, and it's like all these polyrhythms. Everyone sings. There must be 4,000 people on each samba school who parade down it. And the combination of writing music and that feeling of being there and like, oh, my God, music can be like this. It was so profound. So it's fed my whole inspiration and writing. I mean, I've got fixed ideas, but there's an element of that joy of music. But it also, again, like a lot of Brazilian music, there's a dark heart, you know,
melancholy,
but we're all feeling this, we recognize it, but let's celebrate being a human being, because that's part of the journey for most of us. So that's like a, you know, a watershed in my life.
terms of a band, how do you stop the wheels from coming off after 30-odd years?
I don't know.
And maybe I'm thinking about, especially in Rainbows, which took a very long time to make.
Yeah.
And there was a certain amount of difficulty with that.
But I think when in Rainbows, you still felt it, although it was hard, you can still feel it in your gut. You know, it's like, yeah, there's something worth fighting for. I think the moment you feel that you've fallen out of love with it, then I think that's the moment you go, okay, time to move on. I mean, I think it's really important with music, to be honest. And I think we're very lucky. And that's what I love about it. It keeps you asking and feeling your way through and asking, you know, is this right? Do I feel this is right?
And there hasn't been that point when the one person from the band storms out the studio and everyone thinks maybe this is the one when someone doesn't come back.
Yeah, I think so. I think we've had those moments, yeah. But I think that essentially it's the five of us. And you go back to the beginning, it's the five people. And we're very lucky because we have great people who we trust and work with. But the problem is, as you get more successful as a band, you have more people around you. And that's not a problem. That's a great thing as well. But more people get their livelihoods off what you do and all these things. So it can get a little bit complex. So when those situations happen, it has to go back down to the five of you.
Okay.
It has to go back down to the five of us in a room. And, you know, for me, I love the gigs and I love so many aspects of what we do. But, you know, on my deathbed, if I look back at the Radiohead experience, I'll think of us in a room working out songs and the love. And, you know, there's a lot of banter and the laughter and also the tears. Like, oh, God, this is rubbish. And someone's storming out. But that's a place where we're all the most honest. And that's a place when it fits all together. We're not trying to impress anyone else. If the magic is there on that, then you can carry on.
What happened at Third Man Records in Nashville? Because we know you as a band went to go and see Jack White's studio.
Yeah.
And you did some work there.
Oh, yeah.
Where are those tapes? Why didn't we hear it? Are we going to hear it?
I don't know. We did. Well, you know, it was all right. It was okay. I can't really remember. We did it. It was really fun. Jack was so hospitable. Him and his engineer, he's got great sounding, because he records all on 8-track.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Listen, it's not worth waiting for.
That's the answer.
Yeah, that's the answer. It's okay.
There's no amazing
No. I mean, if anything was amazing, you can be assured we try and put it out. Yeah.
Imagine I'm a Somerset farmer, maybe with a beard, but no moustache. I'm rocking that look. I've kind of got a festival, and hypothetically, I was to say, come back, headline. It's about time. There's an anniversary, probably.
Yeah.
What would your hypothetical answer? I don't even know why I'm asking this, but...
Well, I would love to. I mean, I go to Glastonbury every year.
Mm-hmm.
It's my carnival. To be asked to play at Glastonbury again would be magic. And I also think that Glastonbury for us is, you know, it's kind of like our spiritual home. It is the mother of all festivals. We've been very lucky. We played festivals all over the world and there are so many great ones, but there's nothing like that one. Everyone who leaves that festival, we're with our tribe. And that's what I feel like being in Shangri-La at 3 o'clock in the morning. It doesn't get better than this. When we leave, our faith is restored in humanity. You leave and it's like, oh, people can be great, can't they? People can be absolutely amazing. So, yeah, it would be great to play there.
At least can you say that you're going to do some more shows next year? Can we at least?
Yeah, I think we're going to do. Good. Yeah. We haven't. Listen, I'll tell you exactly what the deal is. We've been given some dates to look at. Because what we do is we're not one of these bands that go, right, we're going to 2017, we're going to be at 2018, we've got it mapped out. We're very much on how we feel it. So it's very frustrating for people who work around us. But if we do, and at the moment, the signs are very good because we've been enjoying the touring. Let's just get to the end of it, have that meeting and go, okay, we're going to commit to it. Okay, great. It's very simple. And that's, again, what I'm saying about the honesty, being honest to yourself. Is this still working? Because who knows when the inspiration may leave you? There'd be nothing worse than us trundling out album after album when we didn't really feel it. You would notice it because the music would be like, that record's not. And I've seen so many bands who I love do that. Listen, I'm not judging anyone, but I hope it's not for us.
What's the last song we should play?
I know what it should go back to. So I just want to reemphasize the whole chart thing, like chart music being really, really, really important. Growing up, so I don't know, something like, I've said it before, but Yarborough and Peoples, Don't Stop the Music. I love that track at the moment. That was in a chart in 1981 with Talking Heads were in the top 40. I remember it on Top of the Pops, and that wasn't a song I necessarily loved at the time, but I heard it again, it's just like, this is awesome.
Good to speak to you, thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music. just teach me to despise. Will time make man more wise? Here, within my lonely brain, my eyes just hurt my brain. But will it seem the same? Come tomorrow, will I be older? Come tomorrow, may be a soldier. Come tomorrow, may I be bolder than today? Oh, the trees are almost green, but will they still be seen when time and tide have been fallen to your passing hands? Please don't destroy these.
BBC
Radio 6
Music.
Available on BBC Sounds. Concerts and sessions from the BBC Archive.
This is something we've waited for a long time on the show.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome to the stage at Maidavale.
That is just one of the greatest things I've ever seen, no kidding.
Telling the stories in music that matter now. This is a BBC Radio 6 Music documentary.
How you doing, folks? I'm Huey, your DJ on 6 Music and also the Fun Loving Criminal. You're listening to When We Played Glastonbury. Now, I remember when we played Glastonbury because it was kind of funny. We were sitting out there. It wasn't raining. We'd seen Al Green play. We were all in good mood, sitting around our lawn chairs, having a drink. And then, you know, Mr. Evers came up on his little golf cart and he said that Lenny Kravitz wanted to go on after us because we weren't big enough for him to go on before us. And we were like, cool with us, you know, because we were new to this and we didn't really care. We'd go on now. It was like 2 in the afternoon. He's like, no, take it easy. Just, you know, that's cool. Just, you know, he